Welcome back, folks. Left Reckoning. I'm Matt Lick. With me, as always, David Griscom. Hello, David. How are you?
Man, I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty well. We have a great show for you. Let's get into it. We have a recorded interview with Chase Woodruff. Mm-hmm. He is a journalist out of Colorado. We're going to be talking about a lot of things, about Joaquin Murrieta, an 1854 dime store novel. We're going to be talking about response and resistance to anti-CRT school board shenanigans in Denver, and some other stuff about, you know, water and aquifers and a little bit of drugs. So we've got a good little capsule of Colorado politics with Chase. And we will also get into Elon Musk has been really 100 miles an hour on his mad scientist kick. You know, the whole reason that a society would create an archetype like a mad scientist isn't like to be entertained by it, in my opinion. It's to be prepared for when someone like Elon Musk emerges. And and not only like the mad scientist thing, you have to bring in like a racist scientist too.
Yeah.
And I guess scientists are probably doing too much credit.
No, I mean,
capitalist mascot.
We'll get into it later. Yeah. He's just like, for somebody who presents himself as like, you know, the entrepreneur of the future, he is as old school as it gets from like just like basic labor exploitation. An incredible and horrific amount of racism within those his company, and then essentially, you know, bribing and trying to push local governments and state governments to do his bidding. I mean, he is a throwback rich guy if there ever was one.
Yeah, and also I have details on the story: drilling holes into animals' brains and putting microchips there in a way that is getting sued for animal cruelty. And yeah. Disgusting guy. Sorry, Elon Musk fans. We are not going to be we're going to try to be objective about the guy. We're not going to be, you know, I guess.
We'll read some direct quotes and you can make your own decisions about how you feel.
Yeah.
How about that?
We'll read some direct quotes we don't necessarily want to read.
Yeah, that's true.
In public. But before then, we have some positive news.
Mm-hmm.
From the Howard Schultz Suck My Dick Department. what did Starbucks do here, David?
Well, we got a lot of Starbucks news, and you know, I think most people watching this are aware there has been a historic rise of unionization efforts within the company, including successful attempts in Buffalo, and we'll go back to that place in just a moment. But we want to start with the positive here, right? Because you know, there's some technical aspects to how this union was formed and the specific strategy that has been successful here that are actually very interesting. I mean, this attempt is very, very novel and new. It's not typical for example, for an organization to sort of try to do this store by store strategy for a company that is as large as Starbucks. And there's some reasons that hasn't been attempted in the past, but it's paying off. And we're seeing a huge wave of people who are working at Starbucks saying, you know, enough is enough. It's time to join together with my brothers and sisters and form a union. And we want to take a moment to celebrate that because it's a very exciting development in this country. So this is the first headline right here. Over 100 Starbucks locations have filed for unionization. On Monday, Starbucks workers, it's February 22nd by Sharon Zhang. On Monday, Starbucks Workers United announced that they had officially surpassed 100 locations, filing for union representation, marking a milestone despite the company stepping up its union busting efforts. It's official. We reached the 100 store mark, the union tweeted. 103 stores, to be exact, have filed petitions with the NLRB to join the Starbucks Workers United movement. New filings at three stores in Virginia and one in Wisconsin pushed the count over 100 and across 26 states, so now a majority of states in this country. Two stores have successfully unionized so far, and thousands of workers are in the middle of organizing campaigns at their stores. Now, a company with an extremely nasty track record with trying to break previous attempts at unionization within the company has, of course, pushed a very, very nasty anti-unionization campaign and are fighting tooth and nail all of these people who are organizing. We'll talk about some of their some of the things that they're doing at other locations. But again, celebrate your victories when you can. This is a really great story right here. Hell yeah. Shout out of the week to Microsoft Outlook. Starbucks tries to slow union elections, but misses legal deadline by 8 minutes. As more baristas around the country seek to unionize, Starbucks has used a massive legal team to slow the pace of union elections. But the coffee chain suffered a tough legal setback on Friday, all thanks to some late emails. Workers at several stores in upstate New York recently petitioned for union elections, just like the two stores in Buffalo that successfully unionized last year. But Starbucks, through its lawyers from the nasty little firm, Littler Mendelson, has asked the NLRB not to move ahead with the votes, arguing the elections for individual stores aren't appropriate. The companies wants all the stores within the region grouped into one big vote. And, you know, just so people understand, you know, They do this to try to increase the pool of voters, you know, to try to make it harder for a union campaign to be successful, because union campaigns are hard to win. You know, there's a lot of organizing and a lot of trust that you have to build. And if you can expand the amount of people who are able to vote, whether or not they want to be in a union or not in a union, you know, it makes it much more difficult, obviously, for you to win that election. That's what they did in Bessemer, Alabama. You know, this, you know, these people are very, you know, are paid very, very well, you know, to try to use these tried and true tactics. But the great thing that happens here is, despite all of their homework, and, you know, they're reading their anti-union playbooks through and through, the lawyers absolutely failed at one of the most basic parts of, you know, bureaucratic meddling here. Because they did not send in the documents to the NLRB in time, because of what they claim was a failure in Outlook, and they missed their they missed the deadline by, you know, I think about 8 minutes, and the NLRB said, "Well, tough luck. You know, you wouldn't allow you know, the unions or the union organizers to get away with something like this, so we certainly aren't going to let you get away with something like that." So. Very, very great. And, you know, hopefully that helps the people in the rest of New York State organize themselves into a union.
And that would have delayed the elections, right? Which is,
it would have delayed the elections. Yeah. It would have made it more difficult for, it would have created a higher threshold that they had to reach. I mean, this is a good story, but it is an unfortunate peek into what's going on all across the country, because this is not the only place that these firms are, you know, working on behalf of Starbucks to try to delay or make these union elections more difficult, right? You know, Starbucks has come down really, really hard, which is why it's so important for everybody listening to this to continue, you know, to follow the story. I mean, at this point, it's starting to get to a place where you can find the store in your community and, you know, find ways to get involved and to help them out. Because people need all of the help and the financial support that you can give them, because Starbucks really is threatened by this move. You know, some things were floating around Twitter the other day. Starbucks is hiring, you know, anti-union propagandists to do marketing stuff for them, you know, to attack unions internally. You know, they really are, you know, prepping themselves for a fight. So, this is a good time to show your class solidarity and find ways to get involved with your local campaigns. Because I promise you, you know, there are certainly some in your area at this point.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, the franchisee model is sort of like, we're all kind of different groups until it's no, let's all centralize this vote into one giant thing. Interesting.
Yeah, and I want to note, you know, some of the bad, though, too, because this is important to show support. In Buffalo, where they won their election, and remember, like, this is one of those things. It's the same thing with, like, us, like, winning power and politics, right? You know, winning the union representation is, like, only the beginning of the fight, right? Because then you have to have win your contract negotiations, right? Like, these are, like, long-term fights. And, you know, companies like Starbucks are very willing to take their time, you know, wait for people to stop paying attention to start to retaliate. So, this is from more perfect union, a Starbucks attempting to force out union leaders at Buffalo stores. Multiple leaders of the Starbucks union drive in Buffalo, New York, have been warned that they may be fired in the coming weeks as a result of policy shifts planned by Starbucks management after the first successful unionization effort at one of the company's U.S. stores. And the story goes on to talk about one of the lead organizers in the successful Buffalo election, who is now Cassie Fletcher, who is now essentially being let go by the company because they're saying, oh, well, you're not working enough shifts at this location to maintain your employment, right? It's all kind of really sneaky, non-direct reasoning for why they're sort of forcing this person out. But come on, it's clear as day why Starbucks is letting people go. It's because they think that if they can sort of strike fear in the hearts of the other people employed at these facilities, that they can get away with sort of defanging the union, maybe even getting it decertified. And again, their reasoning is that this person is not working enough hours at the facility. But like, that's Starbucks' whole business model.
Yeah.
Right. Literally, Starbucks is, presents itself as a company that is a great place to have a part-time job, right? Where you don't have a 40-hour weekly responsibility, but you can come and work a couple shifts, which is good for Starbucks too, because it allows them to sort of fill in holes in their scheduling. I mean, it's complete BS. And as you know, the story in the More Perfect Union, goes through, it's like, there was no option for anything here. It was literally like, oh, well, now we're changing our policy about a minimum amount of hours that you need to, be showing up for, which is complete BS. But that's not even the most egregious one. In Memphis, where there has been a very, very exciting and popular attempt in the sense that like a lot of people have been showing up to support folks, organizers have been fired. And like, Matt, I know you know this too. They've been fired for the most BS stuff, like things that are like technically in the rule book in some, small print somewhere on page 72, but rules that nobody follows. Things like, oh, we opened up the door after the store was technically closed to let an Uber Eats worker pick up some, the food. Yeah. Or, oh, you went behind the counter after your shift and you weren't wearing your apron. Which is not allowed technically, right? Again, which everybody does, including management and including owners. Yeah. But now it's being used retroactively to, force out people.
It's selective or opportunistic enforcement, basically.
And this is, again, and like, it should be clear as day to people right now that Amazon is engaged in extremely illegal and unethical union busting. And the real shame here is that in this country, we have a very toothless system for enforcement of labor law. But I want to share this right quick, because this is, again, from More Perfect Union. This is Memphis, and this is just showing the kind of really, really nasty ways that Starbucks is trying to prevent unionization from happening at their stores across the country. And also is a reminder of how much this company fears community involvement and community engagement in this process here. So we can watch this and let the video speak for itself.
Because they knew you guys were coming today, and because we were having our sit-in and we were speaking to media today, they have closed our store. They're saying it's because... Yes. Word got back to the store manager and district manager about that. So today our store was closed. They said it was because of a positive COVID case, but and history has it, we've never closed the store immediately and all day for COVID cases.
Right.
Usually the store manager and district manager tried to find a way to keep that store open for the day, but today we were completely closed. It's completely anti-union. Obviously was a plot and a ploy to stop everything we were trying to do today.
Well, all the more reason not to.
Yes, exactly.
It should speak to the real fear that this company has of union and worker power. This is a company that's so greedy, they're willing to potentially infect the public and certainly infect their own employees. You know, by keeping, you know, their store open when people have, you know, have had, you know, positive tests for COVID, you know, they're willing to keep it open for that. But they're so worried about some people standing outside of a store with signs and showing that there's community support for the workers at the at that that location, that they would actually forego all the profits that they'll make in that day, you know, to try to stifle any kind of labor organizing.
Yeah, I do want to share this. This is their GoFundMe. Support Starbucks, a fired Starbucks union leaders in Memphis. They're at 59K of they need to get 70. So they need a few more donations. I'm going to donate after we get off here. I mean, I'm glad they got that much so far. And, you know, bless these people for doing this.
Solidarity with the organizers and the Starbucks workers in Memphis. Solidarity to the folks in San Antonio and all across the country. I mean, this is a fight that, you know, we'll be covering a lot on this program because it's really important. It's exciting. And, you know, they're up against one of the most powerful brands and corporations in this country. You know, continuing to take that fight and continuing to win is how we build even stronger and larger movements in the future.
As to the structural reasons why this approach wouldn't have been tried in the past, what's that theory there? And then is there anybody thinking like why this might be like working a little bit better than theory may have suggested now?
I mean, I think, you know, this would be a conversation that would be better had with somebody who's like really engaged in like mm-hmm. labor organizing. But, you know, the general sense of it from what I understand is that one, you know, the Starbucks union is a sort of non-traditional union formation, right? So it's sort of separated from like the more traditional unions that we're familiar with who organize in these spaces. But also when you're trying to organize across the board, that means that you have one fight to win. Versus these where it can sort of be, you know, sort of dissipated where it's like, you know, you could potentially only have, you know, one union, you know, in Buffalo, right? And like all the other ones fail and like that, well, that's, you know, limited in its success. Right. And also it creates a situation. This is the one thing that I think is really important about discipline here, a situation where you have actually a bunch of competing unions, at Starbucks, right? And that creates problems too, right? Like if you have like a completely different union organizing in, you know, in Ithaca and a completely different union organizing in Buffalo, you know, that can create a lot of tension as well. And, you know, sort of create a situation where, you know, Starbucks is sort of pitting unions against each other as well. But I mean, you know, this is one of those things though. It's like, that's the conventional wisdom.
Yeah.
And, you know, this has shown that like there is this kind of like more, it's like, this is like guerrilla warfare kind of union organizing essentially. Mm-hmm. You know, that might not seem always like the, you know, the most reasonable approach to take, but as you see from time to time again, like guerrilla warfare ended up being very successful in revolutionary movements all around the globe, including in this country. Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, it might just be time for a different, you know, and novel strategies. So
time to see what works. Sticks, basically. Yeah, exactly.
but I would love to hear somebody be able to break that down a little bit better than me, but that's my understanding of it.
Interesting. Well, folks, we will get back to you with the Elon Musk portion after this segment here, but we're getting tired. I had a good long discussion with Chase here, and I'll be back with half hour.
Well, can we pitch? Yeah. We should pitch our Sunday show mm-hmm. to folks too.
Okay, so we have the St. Louis Commune, a book that looks very well. It doesn't just look. I'm about halfway through it now. By Mark Kruger, the St. Louis Commune, Communism in the Heartland. It's a very good. You know, there's a few chapters going over stuff that I think. Like the First International and stuff like that, that I think folks might be appreciated the refresher. People, it might mm-hmm. be old news to some, but as far as like how the St. Louis, like the general strike, 1877, and I mean, a lot of interesting articles. I'm trying to pull up the here I got it. I was put up my screen. But yeah, St. Louis Commune of 1877. We got Mark Kruger on. We're going to have him. You're not going to want to miss that. Patreon.com/leftreckoning. I wish there was a way for me to have like a RSS feed of books that are like absolute definite let's get on Left Reckoning, because this is the second
this
I saw
coming for this.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, this is like an incredible story of, you know, an American movement really doing some radical organizing and taking on the state directly. So,
and you hear like the specter, specters haunting Europe, right? Specter of communism, the Communist Manifesto, not just Europe. So come to find that the German immigrants in the fucking plains had some familiarity with that stuff and those organizations. I'm super excited about this sort of stuff. And you know, it's interesting because we talked about this and like how certain Marx's writings didn't get out until like, you know, this century, the 1960s, for instance. But I think that like there's that lesson, which is important to remember about how recent this stuff is in terms of like the battlefield of ideas. But also like the communists were making a huge splash. I didn't realize how much of a splash you're making domestically here in America. Even in that time period, you know, following the Civil War and the influence of the Paris Commune and that sort of stuff. So we're going to get into all that with Mark Krueger.
It's super cool. I mean, you know, nearby me in Comfort, Texas, there was a pretty radical attempt to build, a social society out there. And this is pre-Civil War. So it was like radical German abolitionist socialists, trying to build a radical and different kind of community. And the tragic ending, when Texas seceded from the Union, they refused to pledge their allegiance to the new Confederate government and were slaughtered at the spot. But it is just like this kind of radical history, actually, of these you know, these German dreamers and socialists in this country, particularly in, you know, the parts of the U.S. too, where that hadn't really been settled in the same way that like New York or, a lot of the East Coast was. I don't know. It's cool. So
and it's crazy. Like the strike breaks out and the mayor is on the side of the strike, initially, because like, all the fucking voters are like German radicals and stuff like that.
I love it.
So
that will be fun. On Friday, I'm also going to be doing a stream. I didn't do one on Tuesday. We're doing a Q&A stream, and also Matt might be getting on the Twitch.
Yes, tonight after the show, I'll be doing a Left Reckoning feed. I'll be doing a Twitch stream. Be playing. Perfect. I don't know.
There's no post game tonight, but
yeah, don't know if what I'll be listening to. If anything, maybe I'll just be chatting. But I will be playing Ultimate General Civil War. I can tell you that much. So
hell yeah. All right, y'all. Well, enjoy this interview. It's a hell of a lot of fun.
See you in a half hour. We'll talk about Elon Musk's. Welcome back, Left Reckoners. I'm Matt Leck. With me, as always, David Griscom. Hello, David.
Hey, man.
And joining us now is Chase Woodruff. Chase is an environment and economic policy reporter at Colorado Newsline. He also writes the Lit Out West Substack about literature and history of the American West, which is in part of – actually, both of those roles are going to come into question here. Chase, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
And I should just say it's at DC Woodruff if you want to follow him on Twitter. You have this piece, and I wanted to share it right now. It's because it really speaks to me, frankly. Like this is right in line with what we do at Left Reckoning, which is like a deeper history of and like especially regional histories of things that are kind of forgotten. But it's also in line with my other project, Literary Hangover, because there's a dime novel that it comes at play here. So I want to just put this up here for folks so they can go read it. It's a long piece, really well written. This is, you know, we've had Aaron Thorpe on a few weeks ago, and it's nice to have these folks who I don't know if you were an English major, Chase, but like
I was.
You were okay.
Could you tell from this piece?
A little bit, yeah. And as an English major myself, I think there's a little bit of a signs there. But just extremely well written. Myth and Memory in Joaquin Murrieta, How a Forgotten Cherokee Writer's 1854 Dime Novel Wove Its Way into the Chicano Movement, the Modern Western, and Batman. So first, let's start with who was John Rollins Ridge, the writer of this novel? And what is sort of his, I guess, family history? You mentioned he's a Cherokee writer. I believe his Cherokee name was something like Yellow. I should look this up. Yellow Dog or Yellow Bird?
Yellow Bird, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And who was he?
Yeah. So he was a mixed race Cherokee, Cherokee father, white mother, born in the 1820s, you know, when the Cherokee Nation was still living on Cherokee Nation land in Western Georgia and kind of that area around there. You know, this was a period when Cherokees, you know, especially were really pursuing this policy of assimilation and trying to adapt to the ways of, you know, European American civilization. And they wrote their own constitution that was very modeled on the American Constitution and sort of attempted to accept this bargain that was kind of laid out to them in theory, which is, you know, if you, you know, quote unquote, civilize your people and kind of adapt to modern, you know, agricultural methods and things like this, that we won't just steamroll over your territory and dispossess you of all your lands. And, you know, as we know, that turned out to be, you know, the Cherokees tried their best and we still kind of didn't, the U.S. didn't hold up their end of the bargain. And eventually, you know, dispossessed Cherokees of all their land. Obviously this became, you know, Indian removal policy and the Trail of Tears. And that was, you know, the first, John Rowland Ridge, his the first 10 years of his life was just this kind of brutal campaign of ethnic cleansing. And he, his family ended up in Arkansas. He was kind of, he was born into this, you know, a pretty, you know, almost an aristocratic family of Cherokee leaders. His family owned slaves. And they were some of the folks who kind of, in a very controversial move, signed a treaty that sold a bunch of Cherokee lands that was against Cherokee law. And to enforce that law, which the punishment was execution, some of their Cherokees murdered John Rowland Ridge's father, his grandfather. And yeah, I think he was 10 or 12 years old at that point. So that was kind of certainly researching his piece and going back and learning about some of that early history. It was interesting to me, you know, approaching some of the themes and content that is so much a part of kind of the Wild West and Western American literature. You know, this was stuff that was going on in Georgia in the 1820s, and there was a gold rush there, which was really a big part of why Cherokee lands were seized so aggressively back then. So it was, you know, it was kind of there from the beginning, these sort of themes of land grabs and dispossession and ethnic cleansing and this westward expansion.
Yeah, and you mentioned in your piece there's so much that's a microcosm of the West in general. And just that the signing of that treaty, that the way that that's sort of done is a microcosm for how it's generally done, which is that you select a certain part of a tribe to sign the treaty that other parts of the tribe aren't super happy about. And then you don't even really fundamentally honor that treaty either often, right? So it's awful on both sides. But yeah, so that is the context for this guy who writes this novel. Now, the life in what is oh shoot, I had it written down, the full title, but of
I think it's Life and Adventures of Joaquin Murrieta.
That's it. Yeah. So he writes the Life and Adventures of Joaquin Murrieta. Who is Joaquin Murrieta? What's that sort of what is Joaquin Murrieta?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a matter of some debate, and you know, there may never be a perfectly satisfying answer for whether this was a real historical figure or not. So John Rowland Ridge, you know, as we talked about, he ends up in Arkansas with his family, grows up there, eventually makes his way out to California in, I don't think he was technically a 49er. I think he got there in 1850. And so he was out in, you know, the Sacramento Valley during the gold rush. I think he did go out there to mine for gold, like everybody else. He didn't strike it rich, but turned to newspaper writing and editing. And in 1854, he released this novel that was kind of a collection of this tale of this outlaw, this bandit, Joaquin Murrieta, that had kind of spread as legend throughout the California gold fields. Like I said, you know, there's debate. It appears that there was at least somebody named Joaquin Murrieta. There was an early act of like the California legislature that formed a ranger force to go hunt down these bandits that named five Joaquins. But really, you know, to understand the context that this was taking place in, Mexican-American War, it ended with the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848. That is how the U.S., you know, conquered for Mexico half of its territory and California and much of the American Southwest. And there were, you know, there were thousands of, you know, they're referred to as Californios, the Mexican California residents, in addition to, you know, tens of thousands of indigenous peoples still living in California. And the U.S. seized the territory and started engaging in a pretty, you know, brutal campaign to force the Californios out of California. And, you know, that was sort of, that's the context that this Joaquin Murrieta legend kind of forms in. And the story, as John Rowland Ridge told it, is that Joaquin Murrieta was a Californio. He was born in Mexico and moved to California when it was Mexican territory to mine in the gold fields. It was seized by the U.S. and was victimized as part of, you know, this campaign of terror to force people of Mexican descent out of the newly acquired California territory. You know, is as Ridge tells it, his family is murdered. He's, you know, at one point he's almost lynched, and embarks on this campaign of revenge and sort of vigilante justice. He's, you know, in some versions of the tale described as sort of this Robin Hood figure, and others he's more of a, you know, straightforward villain. But that's kind of where this legend came out of.
And in Ridge's tale, and he's pretty sympathetic. I haven't read this novel, but he's pretty sympathetic with Murrieta. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, one of the reasons I started really, really digging into this and reading the book and some of the stuff surrounding it is, you know, it's not often you see this cited as like kind of the first Western novel or the first tale of the Wild West. I think there's a pretty good case to be made that it is. A lot of the kind of Western tropes, the outlaw with the heart of gold, and various others kind of are first see them here. And obviously, you know, this is a time when the Wild West is becoming a thing and with the gold rush and carrying on in the 1850s. So, you know, I think as you're mentioning, like, I think it is understandable that it may not be cited in an American context as the first Wild West tale, because it is kind of a fairly sympathetic, you know, story. It is, Ridge wrote it as a kind of like moralizing tale, to, you know, I think he gets pretty didactic at points and saying like, this is what happens when you have race hatred and you oppress people based on their race, they, you know, that you'll have this kind of vigilante justice. But, you know, yeah, he is Ridge's original version of the tale was definitely very sympathetic to, Murrieta in terms of, you know, justifying sort of some of his actions.
Yeah, I mean, that's the sense I got. It's sort of like a Robin Hood, but with a lot more of sort of American race hatred at play.
Yeah, I mean, it is, you know, this is a novel. The novel is not, you know, it's not the best writing you'll ever find, but it is, yeah, it's certainly significant in the fact that it was a fairly popular early Western story where the, you know, protagonist slash anti-hero, whatever you want to call it, is kind of talking about, as he does in the book, slaughtering Americans wholesale and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, there's certain elements like that part, the part that he's mixed race, that make it a little bit easier to understand why he wasn't canonized. But his work is coming up. I'm seeing it more and more. I feel like, you know, there's more and more people are talking about, not to go Trump all of a sudden, but that kind of takes us to a broad question we want to throw at you to sort of represent Colorado for us for a moment. We, you know, we set this sort of context of
dispossession of native folks, gold rushes. What do folks need to think about, like, if we want to look into our time or our capsule for Colorado, what do people need to be thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, as we're talking about this in this historical context, certainly Colorado, its identity has, its history is wrapped up in being a frontier state. I know you guys were talking, I guess you're kind of doing some of these state by state looks. And I listened to you guys talking about South Carolina, and obviously so much of South Carolina is wrapped up in the early history of slavery and the Civil War. You know, Colorado wasn't a state until 1876, and really wasn't settled until the early 1860s. And so it kind of takes place in a historical context immediately following that. And you have Western expansion. Anytime I'm kind of talking about this, I recommend folks check out Greg Grandin's book, End of the Myth. It's really fantastic, just study throughout American history about how the frontier operated in American society, and sort of in the Civil War era was kind of referred to as the people called it the safety valve. You kind of dissipate sectarian tensions between the North and South by saying, hey, here's all this free land to the West that everybody.
It's free real estate.
Exactly. And obviously, that worked up until a point, and you had Bleeding Kansas. But anyway, following the Civil War, and you really have Colorado and sort of the interior Mountain West being settled. And that's where you have, the Indian Wars of the 1870s and 1880s really getting into, pretty brutal systematic dispossession of natives. We were talking about treaties. In the late 1860s, the U.S. government changed its policy and just said, we're not going to do treaties anymore because we're not going to recognize sovereignty of native nations as such. We're just going to deal with them as kind of, internally displaced peoples almost. And, that was Colorado. So it's really important to understand that as part of the history. And then you have a pretty, Colorado has always been based on commodities and mining and recently oil and gas. That's kind of a big part of our history here. And I don't know if we want to go all the way to the present day or what. You
yeah. Well, we were touching before we got on about the thing that out of staters think about Colorado as North Dakota. And like, I know people's parents are retiring there. So like, let's talk about one of the fastest growing states, I'm pretty sure. What's going on internally with the Colorado's economy there?
Yeah, I mean, just flipping forward all the way to like the 80s and 90s, back then, I think, as we were talking about before, I'm a transplant. I've been out here 10 years. There are lots of folks like me out here who have been moving here since the 90s, especially over the last 10 years. And that influx of kind of transplants who are, tend to be upper middle class, white, have jobs in, the information or tech sectors. That's driven a lot of change in the state politically. It has pretty quickly turned Colorado into a fairly solidly blue state. I mean, it wasn't that long ago when it was, you could really say it was pretty solidly purple, but I don't think there's a lot of folks who would agree with that anymore. Some of the Democrats kind of, like to say still that it's a purple state in order to justify kind of running more moderate candidates who they feel like they could win. But and that's been a big part of the story here.
I just want to say, and with that too, like, from my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, like, there's been a real threat to, particularly water in the state, with people using it, some people using it, just as sort of like, vacation property and things like that, more and more pollution and like pretty extreme factory farming too. Like, whenever we talk about water on this show, like
Colorado is a place that seems to be at the top of the list for states that are very, very, like they're really reckoning with what I think a lot of people are sort of, you know, assuming the future is going to be like, where fights over water and water rights are going to become more and more important politically.
Yeah, for sure. It's, you know, it is, as you said, it's like mostly, you know, we have a long way to fall. Not to say that we couldn't, but we have a long way to fall until, you know, water supplies get to a point where, like, you're talking about shutting off like municipal water supplies. I mean, you know, 80 or 90% of the water is used by the agriculture industry. And certainly if things keep trending the way they are, I mean, the Colorado River Compact, the Colorado River is basically the river that, and all of its tributaries that supply water to the entire American Southwest and some crazy number of tens of millions of people. You know, that compact was signed in the third. I mean, we're really getting into water rights. Water rights are that compact was signed at a time when like the levels, even in historical context, it was signed in the 20s when the water levels were like much higher than they are typically. So even before you factor in climate change and like sort of the continuing Western drought, that the Colorado River Compact was not going to produce some real, you know, hard choices for a lot of these states out here. And we're entering a period where that's stuff like that's going to have to be renegotiated.
Yeah. That's scary. Is Colorado River the one that goes through Phoenix too?
It doesn't get down to Phoenix, but it certainly, a lot of it is, you know, transported down there.
Right. I mean, yeah, reading about aquifers and stuff like that is not the most existentially like cheerful sort of conversation.
no.
You have a piece here in Colorado Newsline, Chase, that I thought was very interesting from earlier this February. I'll put it up here. And it's teachers, students protest new Douglas County School Board. School board's alleged plot to oust superintendent. Newly elected conservative majority has moved to reverse mask wearing equity policies. Walk us through what. So, the most recent election, I imagine they were running on this sort of things. Like, what's going on here with this story?
Yeah, so this is Douglas County. It's South Denver suburbs. I think it's like the third largest school district in the state. It was narrowly elected a new conservative majority in November, and they, you know, pretty quickly got to work, and they rescinded the mask mandate, as you saw in that headline there. And there was an equity policy that was passed last year by the district, and you know it's like a lot of these things that are being debated at school districts all over the country. You know, it was kind of just a fairly, you know, in one sense, uncontroversial sort of anti-bullying policy, laying out some of these, you know, we ran a story. I didn't write the story, but my colleague reported, talked to students there who, you know, in this very pretty conservative South Denver suburb, students of color who had faced like horrible bullying and harassment there. And so this equity policy was designed to help ameliorate some of that. And the new conservative majority, when they're on Fox News, they say they're getting rid of the equity policy. When they're kind of talking to other folks here, they kind of say, no, we just want to change it a little bit. It's been kind of funny because they say that, and then you have like Chris Rufo on Twitter sharing stories, like thanking them for gutting the equity policy. So, you know, like I said, these things are happening in school districts all over the place, all over Colorado, all over the country.
Now they are. And one thing that was interesting about this, though, is there is a response to it. What was the straw that broke the camel's back, and how did people respond?
Yeah. So kind of in pretty weird and dramatic fashion, the sort of this is a 7-member board. The 4 new members are conservatives. The 3 previous are kind of more progressive. And the 3 members who are in the minority kind of started blowing the whistle and holding these public meetings saying, we're hearing that the four new members are kind of secretly working to fire the superintendent. And, you know, there were a bunch of different allegations made. I mean, it seemed to be a violation of kind of the district's personnel policies. There was like possibly some like open meetings. Like, you can't have four members of a board decide behind closed doors to do something like this. They say they were kind of like playing phone tag and I think it's like a walking quorum or a rolling quorum where no more than two of them were meeting at any time. So anyway, they decided ultimately to fire the superintendent. It was this very long and weird meeting where they wanted to go into executive session to fire the superintendent. And the superintendent said, no, I'd prefer you to do this out in public if you want to fire me. And they clearly were not prepared for that. They kind of couldn't really articulate why they wanted to get rid of him other than they just wanted to go in a different direction. And ultimately, you know, this guy who'd been with the district for 25 years and who, you know, prior to a few months ago, I don't think he would have had anybody complaining too much about, just got the boot and, you know, who now they get to hire their own superintendent, sort of implement their vision for this district.
Right. So like they just saw that there was this equity policy and mask policy, and they said, we need to get rid of the super. That was the first, I mean, not to read into it, but it seems like that they're just looking for a reason, and whoever was the superintendent at that time would have been targeted.
Yeah, I think so. And like, you know, I wrote that story. I went down, you know, as you were saying that there was a reaction. There was in reaction to this, you know, kind of beloved 25-year veteran of the district being ousted. There was a walkout. The teachers did a sick out. Students have done some walkouts. There were, you know, in this kind of sleepy South Denver suburb, there was this big protest with 1,000 people. And, you know, you talk to teachers, and not to say that the mask mandates and the equity policy aren't important, but there's a certain degree when you talk to teachers about this, like they understand, you know, what this new conservative school board majority wants in addition to getting rid of policies like that is, you know, to open more charter schools and to, you know, really adjust kind of those fundamental structural issues that, you know, are always up in the air for public education. And so,
yeah, like I could imagine like certain teachers that maybe like they are like have got the same sort of Fox News concerns about equity policies. But when you start like blowing through procedure to like get rid of administrators, like I think everyone's going to be like, oh, this is a little bit of a concern.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there were definitely, I went down there kind of, you know, I'd followed it a little bit and I was, there were several teachers I talked to. I was like, what do you make about the equity policy and the changes? And they're like, yeah, whatever. We're concerned about our pay and you know, what's going to happen to the future of the district and stuff like that. They don't have it's not a school district that recognizes the teachers union and in terms of collective bargaining rights. Mm. So they're in that at that disadvantage too.
Yeah. And the teacher sick outs thing was really interesting to me as both that they had the organization capacity to stand up to those folks. I think they should be lauded for that. And also the reaction against it to try to discipline them back into, into compliance. Tell people about that a little bit.
Yeah. So I believe, you know, when this sick out happened, there were kind of immediate calls from some like conservative commentators here to release the names of all the teachers who called out sick. This is actually something that they have attempted to do this before in a different school district here. And there was like a court case that, that ruled on whether the names of teachers who called out sick on a given day were like public record or whether that was like privileged personnel information. They ruled that it was public record. So it's a tactic that conservatives have used before here. They did submit a public records request at one point to release all these names and it looked like it was going to happen. And then apparently the person who submitted the request withdrew it. And, you know, I definitely talk to a ton of teachers down there who are pretty freaked out when they hear stuff like this, especially given how, you know, charged these issues have become for a lot of folks. We had an elementary school here in Denver Public Schools where a guy screaming about critical race theory, like, lied his way onto campus and was like roaming the halls, accosting staff and parents. So,
yeah. And I like, it's weird. Cause it's both a vehicle for people who are clearly like, you know, unwell to go into a school and yell at kids. And it also is, I think the main reason that say the Republican Party is interested in this is because it's a Trojan horse to attack schools. Like we had my buddy Chris Leal was running for office in Dallas. And the way that like people in rural Texas is what he's finding, like, love their schools. They want their schools to be protected and invested in. And then you get this other sort of issue in there, and all of a sudden you're not talking about that sort of stuff again. What's the state of Colorado, like, public education? Because I didn't want to follow up the water rights conversation with my question about pot. But my understanding was, weed was supposed to lead to a whole bunch of new revenue and finance things like education, stuff like that. Like, I know I didn't prepare you for this question, but where are we at with that sort of stuff?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a pretty common question. I mean, I think the answer to that specific question is just like the pot doesn't raise enough money. Like people think, you know, it does raise a lot of money, but it's kind of a different scale when you're talking about schools. The other thing, it is like earmarked in the law that like it goes to capital costs for schools, so it like funds like the construction of new buildings and like not necessarily operational costs, but yeah, I think mostly the answer there is just that, which not to say that folks, you know, this is wrapped up when you ask about the state of public education here, like we're a pretty hardcore like ed reform charter school, pro charter Democrat state. I mean, it has been a big thing out here. Our current governor, Jared Polis, he's worth several $100 million, made a bunch of money in the .com boom, and has been a force in state politics for the last 20 years. And he got his start running for the state ed board and being a big proponent of the charter movement here. That's, you know, as it does everywhere, has a lot of funding behind it. And, you know, there is still an attempt. There was just a ballot measure last year to hike pot taxes again a little bit and use that to fund kind of after school tutoring / voucher, very ed reformy stuff. And it failed. So people are kind of sick of being told that pot is the answer to all of our problems here.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's just a good thing to not criminalize that stuff after all.
Yeah, it's probably fair.
Maybe it doesn't need to solve the problem of public schools in America. Well, Chase, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. I can't recommend your piece in the Substack, Lit Out West, enough. This is really speaks to me. I'm all about the mythology that's being lost for folks. So thanks so much. At DC Woodruff, give him a follow. Chase, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Welcome back, everybody. Man, that was a lot of fun talking with Chase.
He's awesome. I can't believe you haven't been to Denver, honestly. We got to get to... I had a very
the thing fun is, like, time. I've gotten really close. I just never have made the leap.
I had a very fun time going to a Rockies game on a superfluity of edibles. And it was a very fun... that is... on a nice day... I mean, baseball stadiums in general are great places to be, but watching a Rockies game at Mile High is very fun. Our Left Reckoning tour is going to be great when we.
I really can't wait for that, man. Specifically, like anything near mountains is always special territory for me. Well, Lord, how do you even introduce this one? This is just really. A really shocking story. And it's not shocking because
you know, people might have thought that Elon Musk was creating a work environment that was particularly nice and safe for people. But I will say, like, I could never imagine anything as egregious as the story that we're about to break down for y'all. You know, this is pretty serious. This is as serious as it gets. So Tesla, their facility in California, there has been a class action lawsuit against the company on behalf of thousands of black workers at their facility in California, which they are now moving, you know, most of their operations here to Texas. And the case against them is about discrimination. And this stuff is really extreme. So let me just pull this up for y'all right quick to share, because Alex Press and has done some really great work covering this story. Workers have made shocking allegations of racism at one of Elon Musk's California factories. California has filed a civil rights lawsuit against Musk's Tesla based on shocking evidence that the company's Fremont plant is operating as a systematically racist, segregated facility where discrimination is the norm. Now, it's very rare that workers are going to sit around and lie when it comes to these things, because especially when you're dealing with a company like Starbucks or Amazon or Tesla, that's tremendous amounts of resources. And also when these companies typically have in their contracts clauses that sort of force mediation instead of lawsuits. So like there's a legal hurdle to even bring these, you know, to before the courts. For most of these folks, right? So you should definitely be believing workers when they make all the effort, you know, to bring something like this forward. But, you know, sometimes when you hear like, oh, well, there's discrimination or there's bias, it's like,
even you know,
you could definitely see that like something bad was going on, but it's like, oh, well, maybe the company can argue this down. This stuff is egregious.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't just like picking resumes from white sounding names over time, yes, right? Yeah. That is pretty much endemic to like capitalism in the modern world. This is like a developed culture of the most rancid type of racism.
And, you know, let's just start here that before we even get into this lawsuit, you know, Tesla had to settle with just one black employee. Right, elevator operator at their Tesla facility, a lawsuit for $137 million. Now, like, I just want you to imagine for a second what kind of racist abuse somebody had to go through for, you know, the courts to decide that they should be paid $137 million. So this is an individual, an elevator operator, right? Like, what are they having to go through on a regular basis? And
the nice thing about settlements is when they take that money, they sign a non-disclosure agreement, so we'll never know.
Well, a good amount of this stuff is like the case is fairly public, and like it's just extreme.
Yeah.
The culture that they're creating here, and it's let me just take y'all through the facts here, and then we can talk about it more broadly. I just say like my jaw is still like, I'm still in shock, honestly, because when I saw the headlines, I had a feeling that it was going to be bad, but I didn't think it could be this bad. So in this lawsuit on behalf of thousands of black workers, it came out that Tesla, the Tesla car company, was segregating black workers. We're going to read some of the language from this lawsuit, and it's really extremely offensive, but I think it's important for us to know exactly what was going on here. So in this lawsuit that was filed on behalf of thousands of black workers, it turns out that the Tesla car company, according to the lawsuit, was segregating black workers into areas that they called porch monkey stations, the dark side, the slave ship, and the plantation. I mean, just the most disgusting and despicable kind of language. It's truly shocking, and that's not even the beginning of it. Management regularly was using the N-word to people. Not once, regularly One worker has been called the N-word by their superiors at the work, not in life and not morally, over 60 times. Now, you know, this isn't one of those things where, like, once it gets to that level, think about the moment when you start to have to think that you need to start counting these up, right? I mean, this is just extreme abuse, right? Throughout, as is probably not surprising to people now, throughout the bathrooms, there's graffiti, swastikas, and KKK symbols, right? Terrible enough on its own, but it doesn't stop there. There was graffiti like this on tables in common areas and even carved into the machinery that is used to build those Tesla cars, right? The discrimination is... is not just about dehumanizing and insulting people. There is also alleged in this case that black workers were required to do the most demanding and difficult and dangerous physical labor. Not that surprising given the areas of the facility that they were being forced into. You know, the company, as I said earlier, has forced arbitration in their contracts, and they do that to force accountability. The people who ended up, you know, signing into this lawsuit had gone to the HR department multiple times, and nothing significant happened. And I think it's really important to note that not only is this a grave threat, to maybe future employees of this company as it's expanding all across the country, but it is also not a coincidence, in my opinion, that 3 days after this lawsuit was filed, Tesla relocated to Texas, most likely out of hope that the kind of state mandates and the state enforcement of this kind of despicable racist behavior wouldn't be as strict maybe in the future in Texas. Bad news for Tesla, though, is you can't run from federal law. And this level of discrimination reaches that threshold. I mean, we got a lot more to talk about regarding this, but do you have anything that you want to say?
This detail here from the Slate piece, you mentioned regulators also say that black workers were subject to slurs and racist graffiti at the plant, that the company was slow to erase, and that they were the most difficult jobs and denied equal promotion and pay opportunities. In a 2017 email that Musk sent to employees that seemed to concern a previous class action lawsuit related to similar issues at the Fremont plant, he wrote that anyone uttering an, quote, unintentional slur, end quote, should apologize.
What is that?
Right? Oh, that's a...
I mean, what is that, just like flop out of your mouth? Like,
I mean, I can think of what that would be, is like somebody with Tourette syndrome who is unfortunately like, yeah, has to say sort of like, yeah. That's not what this is about. This is about like, and when you say a phrase like unintentional slur, you're sending a message. You're sending, yes, a message as if like, and let me just continue the quote because the message is explicit in red. So he wrote that anyone uttering, quote, an unintentional slur should apologize, and that the victim should, quote, be thick-skinned enough and accept the apology. So what message is that sending these folks, right? Like, it's – first of all, be thick-skinned is a weird thing to say. And like an unintentional slur, like that is – you're in fucking fun – fart, like Looney Tunes, like the Animaniacs. Mm-hmm. Like that – You're not taking this seriously at all.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, again, like, I don't know. I almost hate to like to think, you know, dollars and cents on this. But as a company, as an institution, you know, why would you even want to accept something like this that could expose you to these kind of lawsuits? The answer is that they don't think that they are subject the same kind of laws, rules, and norms as the rest of society. And that's a bad thing because the norms that this company is trying to push from like, from just like, you know, this is absolutely horrific. And then you look at the labor practices at Tesla factories. I mean, you know, compare that to other comparable automobile manufacturers. You know, time and time again, we've covered a lot on this show. You know, these factories tend to be some of the most unsafe and more dangerous places to work compared to a Toyota or compared to a Ford, right? And those aren't companies that are really sweet,
right?
You know, and soft and looking out for their people, right? You know, it's also notable too that Tesla is, you know, the only major automobile, you know, producer in this country that is not unionized. And they are extremely anti-union, as we all know.
Yeah, well, I mean, Christ, I can see why.
And I mean, I want to look at some of this language because what you were just saying about the thick skin stuff, which, boy, that's sending me. I mean, the thing about Musk is like, you know, he's obviously is an extremely wealthy person who uses his wealth and power to like abuse and you know, harass people as we're seeing here, or just random people like that, you know, poor gentleman who was trying to save those children in Southeast Asia, right? And he was mad because he didn't want to use Musk's like submarine idea. They started calling this guy a pedophile, right? Like this is just somebody who uses his platform to just harass and take out his own like personal psychosis on other people.
And a platform.
I'm always
just say real quick, like platform one by not any, like what's the Elon Musk innovation really? It was like his billions were made on being in the right, like, you know, the PayPal orbit, like knowing venture capitalists. Anyway, continue.
No. I mean, it's yeah. We'll get to this innovation right here because this is from Tesla. This is their statement right here, and I'm not going to read the whole thing because it's nonsense. But you can find it Tesla blog DF. You know, you see it right there. Let me get it right here. Tesla is the last remaining automobile manufacturer in California. Well, here we go. So this is a kind of threat, right? This is saying like, yes, yeah, we're punishing you for enforcing laws against segregating black workers and saying that you shouldn't call people the N-word.
We'll take our plantation and slave ship somewhere else, folks.
Yeah, and they're bringing it here, which is a nightmare for many people. The Fremont factory has majority minority workforce. Oh, great! You're hiring minorities and you're abusing them. Like, what is the pat on the back they're expecting there? And provides the best paying jobs in the automotive industry to over 30,000 Californians. No company has done more for sustainability or the creation of clean energy jobs than Tesla. Yet at a time when manufacturing jobs are leaving California, the DFEH has decided to sue Tesla instead of constructively working with us, sweeping things under the table. This is both unfair and counterproductive, especially because the allegations focus on events from years ago. Oh, the statute of limitations on segregating black employees and using, I don't want to say those terms they were used again. You know, just some of the most despicable stuff ever. But I want to note one thing, because this is something that Tesla does, and we're seeing from a lot of these kind of companies that paint themselves in a progressive veneer, is saying no company has done more for sustainability or the creation of clean energy jobs than Tesla. Give me a fucking break. I mean, you see, like, what is the insinuation there, right? You use a battery instead of a gas engine in your vehicle, and that means that you should be able to dehumanize people. Yeah. You use a battery instead of a gas engine in your car that costs $50,000 that is only continuing the crisis of like the personal automobile, right? Which is not a solution to climate change. I'm sorry. We need mass public transportation, not more and more private, you know, transportation, but that's a whole other thing, right? But trying to use it, even if it were true, right? Trying to use that as like a halo to say, well, you can't be mad at us because we're trying to do something good. And yeah, we might just be racists and torture people along the way, but it's all for the common good. I mean, this is some real sicko stuff.
Yeah, we have a sort of culture of slurs, but they're poor and they don't have anywhere better to go that will pay them so much. So, I mean, do you want to work with us or do you just want to be, you know, negative Nancys? It's
and it's a big problem. We're seeing it. We're seeing it in wind and solar in particular right now. You know, two industries, which again, you know, it's good. We want to promote renewable energies, but you know, lack of unionization and really shit wages for people and horrible, horrible abuse. And when they get challenged on it, they go to that same playbook. Well, we're trying to prevent climate catastrophe. So sorry, you know, we're paying people subpar wages. Sorry that the working conditions are extremely dangerous. You know, like this is this kind of really, really nasty rhetoric that some of these companies use because they think they can get away with it. Yeah. Because some people say like, well, you gotta, you know, you can't make an omelet against you unless you crack a few eggs, right? Bullshit logic and a bullshit kind of ideology there. Yeah. And again, we're going to go through, I want to talk about the animal thing and then we'll come back to Texas in a second, but I just cannot express enough how dangerous it is that Tesla's doing what they're doing right now, because it's very clear they're in California, they were getting to a place where California was starting to challenge them on the working conditions, on the racist working environment, and on, you know, their kind of refusal and unwillingness to pay taxes to sort of support the social infrastructure of the society that they're living in, that they shipped over here to Texas, where you have just a disgusting group of oligarchs who run our government here, who don't give a shit about anybody, right? We're willing to put this place up for sale to the highest bidder, right? It should really worry people, specifically people living here, about, you know, Tesla building another big factory here, Tesla relocating their headquarters here, because they're bringing that, they're not only bringing that stuff here, they're bringing it here because they think that it can thrive. They're bringing it here because they think that it won't be threatened by our systems here. And we cannot accept that as a people, friends.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned, so the day after that lawsuit was filed, this one comes out. This is from consequence.net. It's a description of other reporting. Extreme suffering. 15 of 23 monkeys with Elon Musk's Neuralink brain chips reportedly died, and the other eight also had severe damage. So this is just from Ren Graves. Out of the 23 monkeys implanted with Elon Musk's Neuralink brain chips at the University of California, Davis, I'll repeat that again, the University of California, Davis, between 2017 and 2020, at least 15 reportedly died. Neuralink was founded in 2016 with the goal of helping people recover from traumatic brain and spinal cord injuries, curing depression and other mental health disorders, and connecting humans to the internet for everything from music streaming to near telepathic communication. Oh, pie in the sky stuff. Why do you hate science if you're skeptical about where this is going? The company has often touted its successes, such as as a demonstration on a pig in 2020 and a 2021 video of a macaque playing Pong with its mind. Project has attracted a great deal of interest from celebrities like Grimes and Lil Uzi Vert, and, you know, people suffering from the actual issues that it purports to want to solve. But skip a little bit ahead to this these findings here. Pretty much every single monkey that had implants put in their head suffered from pretty debilitating health effects. So the PCRM's research advocacy director, Jeremy Beckham, they were frankly maiming and killing the animals. Neuralink chips were implanted by drilling holes into the monkeys' skulls. One primate developed a bloody skin infection, had to be euthanized. Another was discovered missing fingers and toes, possibly from self-mutilation or some other unspecified trauma, and had to be put down. A third began uncontrollably vomiting after surgery, and days later appeared to collapse from exhaustion fatigue. An autopsy revealed that animals suffered from a brain hemorrhage. And so there's been response for these organizations. And I will read that just in the interest of full, you know, just to air out what their response is. But you find out it's not very satisfying because it's really like, we're technically following rules, although that's debatable as the response to that is. And if you want, and you're getting in the way of science if you don't allow us to. So I just want to say this. In their response to the allegations, Neuralink said the use of research animals is nothing new to the field of novel medical devices and treatments, and that a company, they are absolutely committed to working with animals in the most humane and ethical way profitable. Mm. Sorry. Let me say that again. The most humane and ethical way profitable. I'll try it again. The most humane and ethical way possible. There I go, the third time.
yep.
Right. And so while detailing their research process, Neuralink sets blah, blah, blah. I don't read this. I want to get to this response. Neuralink's recent blog post, this is from the PCRM in charge of this suit here. Neuralink's recent blog post defending its use of 23 monkeys for surgical brain implant experiments doesn't change the horrific treatment that the public records reveal. Monkeys were used by Neuralink at UC Davis did have portions of their skulls removed and devices screwed to their skulls. Neuralink did use a substance. By the way, Elon Musk wants to have testing on U.S. Human subjects. He said 2021, and now he says it's going to be 2022. 2022 is this year. I'll continue. Neuralink did use a substance called, quote, bioglue, which was not approved for use in these experiments and has been widely known to be toxic to nerve tissue since at least 2001. Bioglue came into contact with the surface of at least two monkeys' brains, causing damage and hemorrhaging. One monkey suffered for days after the damage. Neuralink claimed that that the animals never forced. I'm not going to read this entire thing, but suffice to say, it's the same sort of bullshit, right? Like, yeah, like the patterns are clear here.
I mean, every kind of stop or question mark, you know, ethically that they faced, they said, oh, we're just going to plow through it essentially. And Lord in heaven, I mean, imagine, you know, the animal testing laws in this country are not perfect, you know, certainly. But Lord, I mean, imagine if, you know, this is them sort of like clawing at the edge of like acceptability for most people. Yes. Imagine if, in particularly like legally, imagine if there were less protections for people. I hate to think about it. I mean, this just goes back to one of these things about Musk. I said at the beginning of the show that, you know, for all the people who try to present this person as someone who, he's a forward thinker. He's a futurist. He's a new kind of capitalist. He's bringing us into the next level. I mean, Jesus Christ, Mass Effect, put him into their like video game lores, you know, basically implying that he was the one who brought humans into space. Right. Just like really, really, incredible and delusional stuff. But that was the, that was the PR game, for most of the 2010s with him. But the fact is this guy is just an old kind of gilded age capitalist, from the racism in his factories to the abuse of animals and nature as much as he can get it on. This is not somebody who is forward thinking, in as much as he is somebody who sees that there are some kind of developments and directions things are going into. And he's willing to put himself and his companies in a position where they will go further in breaking and testing the law than other companies, right? You know, you see that Matt and I did a whole thing a while ago about the autopilot system that he has. And one of the things that's notable is this thought that his company was the first one to develop that technology. His company was the first one to say that we are willing to put it out on the roads when it is not ready to be on the roads, despite the fact that that might kill people, as it has. Right. You know, Google, for example, was also working on autopilot systems. And they said, you know, Google, again, not a nice company, but it was a company that they said, we don't want to put something out there that could potentially hurt people and also hurt our brand's, you know, reliability. Yep. Right. Whatever logic made that decision. The point is that they were saying that, like, you know, the risks here are too high. Tesla and SpaceX, you know, these other corporations, they're willing to push far past what other groups of people are willing to go, and it's to our detriment. I want to say in the animal thing for just a second, but we'll talk about Brownsville in another moment. Where it's like the thing is like this is not us just like, if it was just like maybe one of the companies, you could maybe say, well, you know, this is sort of the excess of like that industry. But if you notice from project to project, you're getting the same stories, you know, it should give you pause.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to read also one final paragraph for this, because I think UC Davis's role needs to be, I think, more like Elon has a certain degree of, insulation from this sort of heat for some reason. I mean, maybe I'll catch up with him. I hope so. But yeah, like, so here's this from this, from a Arena poll of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine that's suing over this Neuralink stuff. In addition, Neuralink's claim that UC Davis was in compliance with federal animal welfare standards is demonstrably false. In 2018, while Neuralink was funding primate experiments at the university, seven infant primates at UC Davis died due to poisoning caused by the negligence of university employees. The same year, UC Davis paid a $5,000 fine to the U.S. Department of Agriculture due to its pattern of violating the Federal Animal Welfare Act. I mean, like, we have to, this is like, this is a clear goal for like doing these segments about Musk, is that when he comes to a place like UC Davis, and I don't know how, you know, ethical they are outside of doing shit for, you know, Musk projects, but, or like a municipality, people are skeptical to the point of wary, right? And that's because that's like, he can't, these partnerships have got to get blown up, because I mean, it's fucking, this is somebody, and this is the problem, is like, who gets to, why does he get to decide this shit? Is because he was in the right rooms with, you know, venture capital people a couple decades ago. And now he gets to sit at the helm of multiple pivotal technologies. And basically where he gets his ideas from is, like you said, what is Google too responsible to do? Let me do that.
You know, and like, we'll pivot to this Brownsville thing in just 1 second, but like this is the point. Cause like, I know I don't want to fix it on too much, but I know eventually this like will get to a certain audience. It's like, oh my God,
you just
don't care? Don't you? You just hate them, and you just, you know, you're saying you're focusing on all the bad, and you're not focusing on the good and the fact that he's trying to put forward these new technologies. No, what I'm saying is that I do think that it is great to start to focus on, to think about ways that we can build, you know, renewable and reliable and safer. For the environment and for other pedestrians, by the way, modes of transportation for people. I do think, you know, that within like the limits of like ethics of and respect for other beings and humans, that it is fine to investigate, you know, the kind of capabilities that we can reach with technology. I do, though, I think that we should find ways to budget, you know, to make sure that we're taking care of poverty and feeding people first. I do want to be a part of, you know, of a human species that is able to venture far off into the stars, right? Like, these are not unique desires of this guy. The problem is that this guy, because of his hoarding of massive amounts of resources, that he only releases with the, you know, with essentially the stipulation that he be in control of everything. You know, and you see again, when it goes to Tesla, like ridiculous design decisions that, you know, are coming from him that make no sense on an engineering level, right? Because he wants, I played a video game when I was a boy and I want it to like look this way, right? You know, the point is like, it's not that we don't want to explore those things. And in fact, other organizations are exploring those things and they would be helped out a hell of a lot by the vast amount of resources that this person has hoarded. The point is that we don't want to see somebody, an individual like this, being able to use outsized power and influence because of the money that they've accumulated, you know, that essentially hampers our ability to reach a lot of these goals, and two, hinders, you know, the rollout of these things because they put out things that are unsafe and dangerous for people and for animals, right? Like, I just, like, I don't want to, like, put all of the hope for, you know, a futuristic society or a better society in the hands of somebody who's an extreme narcissist with a history of, if not, you know, actively, at least tacitly allowing kind of racist exploitative, you know, systems to exist in his companies, and a really extreme top down, you know, authoritarian system within the shop floor and within the organizations that he's created, right? I don't think that's a good mode to get us to the goals that we want to reach. And that's why we oppose it.
And I've had this argument with folks on MR a little bit. Like, I don't even like it. There might be some grain of truth to the idea that he's moved society towards electric cars. But that's not a statement that I'm just going to let pass by and just, like, you know, co-sign. I think there's a lot of problems with that. One, like we already mentioned, with just the problems with the personal automobile. But also, like,
the problem with why we haven't moved to electric cars is a problem of capitalism, right?
Well, but
that go ahead.
No, so I mean, I don't mean to cut you off, but like even within that logic, right? Like he gets a lot of credit for certain things, but like the actual productive capacity, for example, of Tesla is extremely limited, right?
Right.
The point was that the other, you know, like, yeah, automobile manufacturing in this country was very, very prejudiced against electric vehicles for a long time, right? And there's history there. But you could see in the 2000s that, okay, well, now there's a trend and people are talking about it regularly in public, right? They're like, oh, well, we need to go back to, you know, pursuing and investigating, because you know the electric automobiles, like something they were developing in the 60s and 70s, but yeah. Gas was cheaper and nobody was worried about global warming, so they went with that, right? Capitalism, yeah, you're right. But then later when they realized, okay, well, there's limits to this and we need to move, and again, this is not the GMC and Ford and Toyota and all these companies are really sweet and lovely, but they're saying, okay, well, how can we produce vehicles that are affordable and that we can you know, produce on a mass scale? And their timeline was a little bit longer than Tesla's, because people forget how few Tesla vehicles there actually are on the road compared to even just the capacity of what Ford produces in a month versus what Tesla has produced in its entire existence as a company. And as you've seen, you know, the major automobile manufacturers are all now producing mass amounts of you know, electric vehicles, which is a good thing, I would say, generally. Yeah. But like the point is that like they're about to be left in the dust, because like it was never viable from the first thing. And like the big thing with Musk that you will learn if you like pay attention to his history, he promises a lot and delivers very, very little, right? And what he ended up creating was a luxury car brand for a certain group of people. And look, it's great. You know, I'm sure, you know, some people who might be listening to this might even like their vehicle. And I think that's fine. You know, no shade to you.
Shout out if you're like, listening to Left Reckoning in a Tesla.
Yeah. But I will say the promise of what he's saying that he's doing, and when he's saying like, oh, it's okay that we call black people the N word and we quarter them off and segregate them in our, you know, in our facilities, is because we're building a sustainable future, right? That's bullshit. When you look at the actual effect and the amount of, like, you know, what is actually being produced. Again, it would be a bad deal even if they were like replacing the entire fleet of American automobiles with electric vehicles, obviously. But like it's nowhere near even close to what, like, look at what Ford's going to produce in the next year when it comes to electric vehicles that are going to be on the road versus what Tesla's done in this period of time. And like, you realize that like, there's been so much fluff there, but I don't know. I don't want to focus too much on that, but like, these are the technical reasons, you know, why we focus on this person, because it's extremely unhelpful to let somebody own people's ideas of progress and then cynically weaponize those to abuse and harass people, our democracy, when he comes at elected governments, we're going to get to that in just a second, and animals, right? Like, you can't allow somebody to do that, especially if they're going to say, well, you know, critique me if you will, but I'm, you know, I'm saving the planet. Absolutely not. That is not what has been happening and what will happen.
Man, what more do you need to say that the company's response to having segregated areas for black folks called the slave ship was, that was a long time ago. Like,
oh, nice. And we're talking like 2 years.
I mean, yeah. Like,
oh, okay.
I mean, it better been in the fucking 1640s.
Or that you should have a thick skin. You know what I mean? Let's get to this next bit, Matt. This is a little bit of a preview for next week. But let me share this story, because it is really shocking. And, you know, so we've talked about now what we talked about Tesla. We talked about Neuralink. And this is about SpaceX. We covered on the show how I've been arguing that Musk is essentially trying to buy up these towns, towns that have, for historical reasons of racism and class war, have been extremely underfunded and underdeveloped in South Texas. You know, are desperately in need of funding and infrastructure and money. And he's basically come in there into desperate communities, and not just through like the promise, for example, of like, oh, we're going to build a facility here, maybe hire some people, you know, donating some money to a school here and there, donating, you know, to certain kind of projects that are needed in the city. And for somebody who's super, super rich, who should be funding projects like that all across the country through taxes in ways that we decide, not allowing somebody to sort of dictate, you know, to us what we're going to do. You know, it's extremely, extremely, dangerous and cynical. So let's just get to the story, real quick. This is in the Texas Observer, written up by Gus Bova here. Brownsville cops arrest activist for anti-SpaceX graffiti. Mayor posts her info on Facebook. It's a very, you know, fact of the matter title there. But like, so you can see here on the right side of your screen, here's the graffiti in question. Gentrified, I mean, stop SpaceX. I mean, very, very mild. Let's, I mean, let me get to the story so people can understand why this is so wild. I think it's great. It's a great message. 100% support it. Great but like, addition. Let's see, let's see how this, it's a phenomenal addition. It looks a lot better than that fucking, that is the most gentrified mural, by the way. Ever.
Yeah,
like, that is just that, like that, like comes in the box, you know.
Gentrification billboard right there.
So anyway, so Becca Hinojosa, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing your name. We'll be interviewing her hopefully next week to talk more in depth about this. But effectively, you know, so for people who aren't familiar, SpaceX has, you know, been built up in the Brownsville area now, and they have been, you know, sort of buying influence with local politicians and local authorities, not in and not using this money in ways that are, you know, helping out the community in general, but trying to curry favor with certain people. So, Hinojosa, allegedly, you know, graffitied this gentrified stop SpaceX here. And let me just go through the story. Sorry. Hinojosa was in her pajamas Wednesday morning when she heard a knock on the door, probably just FedEx, she thought, though the knock did seem a bit loud. When she peeked through her peephole, she saw a swarm of men. Who is it? She inquired. It was Brownsville police officers. She soon realized were there to initiate what would become a traumatic 24 hours for her that would end in her border city's mayor posting her mugshot and employment status on social media, all for the alleged crime of a little protest graffiti, right? Hinojosa, who's a local environmental activist with Sierra Club and Another Gulf Is Possible, says she cracked the door open and they just pushed themselves into my apartment, grabbed me and handcuffed me. She pleaded for the chance to change clothes. She was wearing a thin shirt, pants, no bra, but the officers refused, even threatening to charge her with resisting arrest. Four officers total, she believes. She was barefoot as they led her out to the car to take her to the police station downtown. The charges that precipitated this, a Class B misdemeanor for allegedly spray painting the words gentrified and stop SpaceX built below a new mural on the side of a city owned historic theater downtown. I mean,
a city owned. So let's talk about free speech a little bit, shall we?
Yeah.
Like that. Like,
tell it, Matt.
I mean, for fuck's sake, it's not even like you can't even run the private property defense, which I obviously wouldn't give a shit about. But this is a city doing fucking advertising for this goddamn freak, which is again exactly why we do all this stuff about Musk, because this shouldn't be happening. It's appalling that this sort of, you know, tycoon gets to advertise his shitty fucking rockets on you know, city landmarks. And I would much rather have a people's fucking message about that on there than that shit.
Absolutely. And let's get back to democracy, though, because this is the other bit that's really frightening. So you see, like let's use the words that are appropriate here, right? Like the police, right? The armed guards of the state, right? Like the domestic army of our government going to somebody's house, pulling them out of their home, not even allowing them, you know, just basic kind of decency, let alone like they shouldn't have arrested her in the first place, right? But let alone like refusing to allow them to put on, you know, shoes and a shirt other than, you know, her pajamas because they knocked on her house early in the morning. Again, for a Class B misdemeanor, I mean, just nothing. Like the smallest, like it's intimidation, right? And why is that? It's because the people in power are bought and are completely bought out by people like Musk, which is why, you know, just to make a point, most socialists don't need to hear again, but it's worthwhile making as much as possible. Rich people are a threat to democracy, Yes. Because they're able to buy outsized influence with our supposedly democratically elected governments, right? But let's just get here. We're talking about this in depth next week, so I don't want to save a good bit for next week. But I just want people to understand what happened with the government here. Around the same time, Hinojosa was released after 24 hours. By the way, she was being abused this whole time, was not being given the kind of basic kind of treatment that you would hope would exist in any case, let alone somebody being put away for, again, a Class B misdemeanor. Around the same time, though, Hinojosa was released. Brownsville Mayor Trey Mendez, a major booster of both SpaceX and Musk, made a public post on his official Facebook page. He included Hinojosa's full name, her mugshot, and a picture of the graffiti, noting that city cameras had captured the graffiti act. He added, "Ms. Hinojosa has been quoted in several anti-SpaceX articles and lists herself as a Gulf Coast campaign representative for the Sierra Club on LinkedIn. Mugshots of arrests in Brownsville are easy to obtain as the police department maintains a blog spot." Site. I mean, that is intimidation. That is, you know, a threat against our ability to express our political views, right? And again, in service of what? In service of an extremely wealthy person to maintain his pet project that is extremely devastating. And again, we'll talk about this more in depth next week, but like extremely devastating to the local environment and extremely devastating to the local community. How many people were really consulted about whether or not they wanted some jackass to be flying up rockets over their head, over their communities, interrupting their daily life, so that he can pursue his own vanity, given his track record, as we've talked about with his vehicles and his other products too, of skirting and avoiding any kind of basic oversight or safety regulations, right? Like, it is 100% the kind of thing that you would want to see in a healthy and thriving democracy, to see people's ability to be able to make their voice heard on something like this. And instead, you get the state cracking down on an activist. You get the mayor of the city caping and being a complete cuck for somebody like Musk. I mean, it's embarrassing, you know, and if only it was just embarrassing instead of an actual threat to our ability to live in a free and open society. I mean, this should be the thing that is getting people worked up right now, by the way, if you're talking about free speech in this country. Talk about the fact that a billionaire is basically able to buy and curry favor with elected officials so that they're using the police to stifle and threaten people for speaking out against the abuses of the said billionaire to the community. I mean, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And Elon Musk, as he has the mayor and local police force marching for him, is an anti-establishment figure. It's a great world to be in.
So hopefully next week's show, we'll be able to talk with Becca, and I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, and if you subscribe at patreon.com/leftreckoning to get us to 1,000 patrons, I'm not making any promises, but I will be in Austin. I don't know if there's any murals that need any touching up.
There's actually a couple. And we could go. I mean, they're building their headquarters here, so we can go visit. Go see if Musk wants to hang out. He's never here, by the way.
Is he in Cali?
Have you seen the guy? Yeah, he's in Cali. He flies from here to Brownsville to Cali. It's like I just hate listening to this guy talk about my home, and I hate what he's doing to other people's homes as well. And let's work for a future where there is no more billionaires. All right, folks. There might be something coming up afterwards, but no promises. If not, you'll be seeing Matt hanging out on Twitch in just a couple minutes. Thank you all so much. Do not miss this conversation that we'll be releasing on Sunday, breaking down the St. Louis Commune. I'm really looking forward to it. It is a really, really crucial and beautiful and fascinating part of our shared history here of resistance and fighting against rich assholes. That's American tradition, baby.
Absolutely. See you, folks.
All right, y'all. See you soon.